Blog Talk Radio.
If you find yourself in trouble, count on me, my friend. I'll get right up in trouble's face. You won't see him again. I've got the backbone, American. I've got the heart, American. I've got the will, American. Will you stand up, don't sit down? Stand up, don't back down. Stand up, shout it out. Stand up, let's make it loud. American, American.
Welcome to another exciting show with Southern Sense on Blog Talk Radio. So turn up the volume and enter our chat room, or grab your phones, call in, and join the conversation. Help us to restore the republic to this country and inspire the majority to be silent no longer.
Well, look me straight in the eye. Tell me what you see. I'll tell the truth every time. Yes, you can count on me. I've got the backbone, American. I've got the heart, American. I've got the will, American. Will you stand up? Don't sit down. Stand up, don't back down. Stand up and shout it out. Stand up, let's make it loud. American, 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 American.
Good afternoon to another exciting adventure of Southern Sense here on Blog Talk Radio. I'm your hostess with the mostest, the radio chick, Annie. And I'm waiting for my co-host, Cool Mike, to call in, so hopefully he'll be in the room soon. Just letting you know, we have a great guest this afternoon. His name is Brett Brayton. He's a former federal agent with several decades of experience. He'll be joining us a quarter after the hour, and we'll be discussing his book, Homeland Insecurity. And I finished the book last night, and it is scary. I'm telling you, it truly is scary. But as I wait for my co-host to call in, I want to remind everyone that we start off each and every show with a dedication to a fallen hero. And today's dedication is to Army Specialist Ross A. McGinnis. So I'll pull up the Army mix, and we will go forward with this dedication while I wait for my co-host. This is from The Military Times by Michelle Tan, with some alterations by me. The convoy of six Humvees left Forward Operating Base Apache the afternoon of December 4th, 2006. The mission was to patrol the streets in a northwest Baghdad suburb and find a place to put a 250-kilowatt generator that would provide electricity for more than 100 homes. Shortly after they left their compound, the soldiers of 1st Platoon, C Company, 1st Battalion, 26th Infantry Regiment turned off a major road. Your
truck, replied McGinnis, who was standing up, getting ready to jump out of the vehicle. McGinnis turned and looked down and realized no one in the truck knew where he was. Captain Michael Apple. He knew everyone entered the combat spot. Instead of jumping out of the truck, I looked out the corner of my eye. Passenger light. A was thrown off its engine. The explosion hit on its side, lower back, my freak back. It was October 5th. Many soldiers of the German base battalion left the unit for a new assignment. McGinnis was part of the 4 months later.
But the explosives typically land outside the up-armored vehicles. When the grenade exploded inside McGinnis' vehicle, Bacchus said he knew right then what it was. The blast was very loud, and immediately following, there was gunfire. He instantly told his driver to turn the Humvee around. I saw two soldiers walk to another vehicle. I knew right away the grenade made it under attack. Thanks to pointing yelled down to his fellow soldiers. Everyone in the truck climbed up the head down. Coach Tom Thomas was conscious of that 5 seconds. The each final aspiration of the bus opened at a large back to a man until I wait to see him open the building to see the damage he had done. I started to think I don't to provide medical aid to Bueller and Newman, Thomas said. In the meantime, the other soldiers in the convoy gathered around the damaged Humvee to provide security. Sergeant Patrick Kramer, one of the dismounting leaders, got Thomas said he didn't know that McGinnis was dead. I saw him still sitting there. I thought, I was thinking last week, in fact, Thomas tried to walk in front of me. I couldn't turn around. Thank you. feel sick. Beginners to support. By acts of gallantry above John, most of their best caliber machine gunner, 1st Platoon C Company, 1st Battalion, 26th Infantry Regiment. They connect that after combat control operations effort to reduce and control and the end caliber machine gun. A fragment made thrown by the surface filled with sun attack. Yes. Yes. No. Then rather five in it. Break. Private McGinnis covered the lives of the saved four men from certain serious injury or death. Private First Class McGinnis. Extraordinary heroism, self at the cost of life. Above and beyond call of duty. The highest of the military service. And what?
I fought for my liberty. I paid with the blood of my people. Freedom has never been free. Now my door's always open to dreamers and friends. But when I'm attacked, I protect and defend. My name is America. I stand proud and free. My name is America. Don't tread on me. I cannot be broken. I cannot be shamed. If you hurt me, I'll get stronger. And I'll rise. I stand for my respect for humanity. Now I'm challenged by tyrants who envy my power, but their vicious deeds become my finest hour. Because my name is America, I stand proud and free. My name is America, don't tread on me. I cannot be broken, I cannot be shamed. If you hurt me, I'll get stronger, and I'll rise up from the flames, and I'll always stand proud and free. I'm America, don't tread on me. America is my name. For those who need me, I'll always be here. For those who will harm me, I'll face without
My Name is America by Todd Allen Herndon. And I want to remind everyone, I have an autographed video DVD of this song of Todd Allen Herndon. It's up on our website, southernsense.webs.com. And if you go to the contest page, you can enter the raffle to win this autographed DVD that I got personally from his hands. And we do have our co-host with us, Cool Mike. Good afternoon.
Oh, good afternoon, Annie. Sorry for being late. The duty of being an entrepreneur.
Yes, I can understand that. And I do have to apologize. I did have to switch from my microphone and headset to a landline because BTR's upgrade is not working with Skype. And I tried working with them for 2 days straight on trying to get it straightened out. And they're telling me it's Skype's problem, not theirs. So for now, I have to use a landline.
Anyone believe that one? Not had a problem with Skype. We've not had a problem for over a year now, and they're doing all these changes. As I mentioned to you off the air, Conservative Primetime twice, no, once we had to kill the show because none of us could even call in. So, but anyway, those are the ups and downs of BTR and the federal government testing its shutdown system for the kill switch.
Oh, yes. Well, we have a fantastic guest. He wrote a book called Homeland Insecurity, Failed Politics, Policies, and a Nation at Risk. His name is Brett Bratton, but we also have a surprise call in, you know, Lieutenant Colonel Bill Connor, who's going to join us. So let me bring Brett on first. Good afternoon, Brett.
Good to be with you.
Yes.
Thanks for joining us, Brett. I got to acknowledge, this is Cool Mike. I'm one of your newest big fans. I've really enjoyed reading, let me tell you, and I am not a big reader.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. That's good. I'm glad to hear that, Cool Mike.
Yeah, and when I went through this book, it was downright scary because here we think that, you know, the federal government, they started up this whole new Department of Homeland Security, and they're telling us that they're initiating all these policies to make us safer. When I got done with your book, I'm going, oh, my goodness. What have they done to us now? It is downright scary, some of the stuff that you outlined. Now, having been a former police officer, I can understand bureaucracy and, you know, different guidelines that kind of like muddle you up and prevent you from performing your job. But it sounds like they really don't want you even to do your job.
I think you could draw that conclusion. And the purpose of the book is I understand the frustration. All of us have come through systems, you and yours, and certainly me with mine. I think your listeners can identify with not getting the straight skinny on what's happening. So this aggravation and frustration out there, raise kids and find out how frustrating it is trying to get to the bottom of what actually is going on, why they came in late. And that, hopefully people will understand that is what this book solves in a way, and to a degree it lifts the veil of all that confusion to give them the straight skinny on what actually is happening to hopefully reduce that aggravation and frustration that they would otherwise normally be feeling.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you want to give us a little background on yourself and why you have the expertise into writing such a fantastic book, which I encourage everyone to read?
Well, I was an agent for 29 years. I grew up on the Canadian border up in International Falls, Minnesota. For anyone who keeps track and watch the weather map every once in a while during the winter, you see it's the coldest spot in the nation generally. So that's where I'm from. I grew up on the Canadian border, worked at the port of entry there, International Falls, and then came on after college and moved a couple of times from Minnesota to North Dakota, another hot spot, and then down to St. Louis where I became an agent. And I spent about 25 years as a special agent, had experience in Washington with headquarters, so I got to, for the short time I was there, it wasn't very long, a couple of months, because I wanted really nothing to do with it. Even then, early in my career, I recognized that that was a feeding ground for the barracuda that swim about in the government bureaucracy. It wasn't meant for, you know, a smaller fish like me. So I stayed out of there, but clearly that's the seat of power. That's where everything happens. And after that, I moved back to Minnesota and ended up running an office in Duluth, Minnesota, on the beautiful shore of Lake Superior, and retired about 3 years ago because I felt, well, I didn't like the way DHS, where it was heading. I didn't like the leadership. And coming out of U.S. Customs Service, which was a fairly well-run organization, I thought this is only watering down the brand. It's time to go.
Yes. Now let's bring on Lieutenant Colonel, or Mr. Carter, did you make full colonel yet, or are you still Lieutenant Colonel?
My board's actually meeting right now. In fact, they finished meeting Wednesday, and I won't find out for about 3 months after that. But I appreciate you mentioning. If I don't get picked up, I'm still happy with the way the Lord's blessed me. But I'm still Lieutenant Colonel. Thank you.
Well, thank you for your service. And see, I didn't forget that you were looking forward to a promotion. Oh, by the way, would you be considering running for Lindsey Graham's seat?
I'll put no comment, but I'm definitely praying a lot where the Lord is leading and how I can best serve the nation, continue to serve the nation. I do feel that call, and I miss the service overseas and everything else. I'd like to do more, so I'll leave it at that. I appreciate, though, your encouragement.
Mm. Now, I've got about 2 pages of notes here that I wrote down, just jotted down last night on your book, Brett. Now, what's the difference between Customs Service today with DHS compared to when you first entered?
The experience we had as Customs Special Agents was that Immigration Naturalization Service was an agency largely plagued by political whimsy of administration, so they really had no clear mission. With Customs Service, we dealt with cocaine and drugs and nothing that had feelings that were going to be hurt. Immigration, for their part, deal with human beings and dealing with political correctness to a degree that we didn't have to cope with it. So we were not looking forward to the merger when Lieberman became involved, Joseph Lieberman. We figured, well, nothing good will come of this because when you make things bigger, it doesn't become better within government. So we knew it wasn't going to be good from the get-go, and we had heard, and I have no way to say that this is gospel truth, but the word on the street was the reason we ended up with ICE, Immigration Customs Enforcement, was that the Bureau, the FBI, had objected to the criminal investigations and enforcement moniker that I think the powers that be, at least in the customs and immigration side, wanted. So I have no way of knowing. It wouldn't surprise me. But here we're stuck with ICE, plus the fact that immigration gets the first name, like Martin and Lewis, Abbott and Costello. They get top billing, so therefore that's what the mission became. So we as customs people, and what we knew, were now forced to learn the immigration part of it, which no one cared about as far as from the customs side. It was like trying to read and understand the tax code. And the immigration people, for their part, couldn't have cared less about customs matters. So you have two disparate agencies with completely different missions thrown together in a very unhappy marriage. And it really has only gone downhill since then. It may have leveled off now, but the degree or the quality of the job that's being done, it's just limping along.
Now, you wrote about, I could actually
feel the frustration when I was reading your words. But you wrote that you were like two different classes of people, where you had the legacy agency agents that were with Customs prior to the merger, and then you had the immigration agents, the INS agents, that really had poor morale is the word I'm looking for.
Definitely. They were represented by a union. They would often throw the union in the way of anything that management wanted to do programmatically or, I would say, as far as policy. So they had that additional problem that we were not represented by a union. In addition, the agents for the Immigration Service could go and work at the airports as inspectors, so they could pull double duty and make overtime. So they'd leave their investigative duties and go clear passengers, which we thought was absolutely crazy town, because we as customs agents could not step out of that guise and now become inspectors just to make extra money. And that was being allowed. So it was this I don't know, a P.T. Barnum kind of approach to law enforcement that we looked upon. We thought, no, great, we're part of this. And, you know, none of us would have chosen it, and I think a lot of people hoped as years went by that there would be a splitting of it once again, where we would end up, that is, the customs agents back with Customs Border Protection under a different level of management and get away from Immigration, Customs Enforcement, now Homeland Security investigations. It's more than likely not going to happen.
Yeah, now, we had Mike Cutler on our last show, and I believe you were speaking with him when we were up at the South Carolina Tea Party Convention, and he had some very, very interesting takes. And if you know Mike, he's a pistol. And he was saying that it's really impossible to actually secure our borders. Everyone's saying secure borders, you know, because you guys are not being allowed to enforce the laws that already exist. As I understand, only 10% of imports are being inspected, and because of political correctness, they're ignoring the need to profile to look for, you know, an improper person, whereas they'd rather go for young children and senior citizens in wheelchairs. And you've got port of entries on not just our borders and the ocean, but we have almost every single state has an international airport.
And
how do you
true.
Do it?
Well, let's just start at the top and start from the Southwest quickly. We have 1,954 miles of border with Mexico. We have studies coming out from the Committee on Homeland Security from the House of Representatives saying that clearly that border is the weakest link in a national security picture. We have 18% of 1,954 miles under actual control by the Border Patrol. We have reduced the level of National Guard troops from 1,200 to 300 troops, who are there largely, I think, for intelligence analysis and not boots on the ground. What the government has done then with respect to that border is they are going to replace boots on the ground, which is the most effective, efficient way of securing the border, with technology. Because technology, you can say, well, it's proven not to have worked. We gave it a good shot. And when you don't have people, you don't have boots on the ground responding to an image on a video screen, what's the point? So that is the bait and switch for border security. You know, putting aerostats up above the border, look down radar on balloons 10,000 feet above the air that are spotted routinely and easily by people on the south side of the border saying, okay, let's do nothing today, the aerostats are up. I'm not even exactly sure. I know they've improved, but I don't know that they're being used. Let's just get away from technology now and go more interior to the nine states along the border, four states, of which Obama is trying to close nine U.S. Border Patrol stations that work checkpoints away from the border to pick up people that have gotten through inspections or gotten around inspections. So now he's proposing that. Then you go on interior, actually everywhere, the 274 program, which is the assistance to state and local law enforcement, 274G, which authorizes law enforcement, you know, provided they've gotten the training from Immigration Customs Enforcement, to ask the questions of people that are lawfully in custody for some other violation. So the word on the street from management in the Oval Office is you're not going to help. We don't like the Supreme Court decision that came down in favor of Arizona for one of the provisions allowing law enforcement officers to act that. So we'll have a workaround, and we'll say now you're not going to work or respond to their calls for help anymore. So our guys, my colleagues, are telling me we're going crazy. In fact, we have 10 agents from detention removal that work with state and local law enforcement and the jails to get the aliens back to their home countries that are suing Napolitano, John Morton, the head of Immigration Customs Enforcement, and DHS for what they claim are constitutional violations, being told you're not allowed to do your job.
You know, Bill, because we're here in South Carolina, you and I, we recently had federal funding cut to our immigration programs where we were working with local law enforcement. Do you want to weigh in on that? Because I know our own sheriff down here is trying to work around that by moving these officers into the prisons where they will run everyone's background check, but they're no longer able to do it here on the street.
Yeah, it did appear to be almost somewhat of a targeting of certain of the states, like South Carolina, which sort of followed suit with Arizona and the legislation they were attempting to pass. And that did look very fishy in what occurred. And in one of my jobs right now, I work with someone in immigration. I'll leave them nameless for the moment. But it is interesting sort of the what happens to the states that have sort of taken the stand of, look, federal government, you're dropping the ball here. We have got to protect ourselves. And, you know, where you drop the ball, we're going to pick up. And then to watch what's occurring, issues like the funding and other things too. And, you know, I think one thing to possibly add here, and I'm not the expert on this end, but something I have seen just within the federal government as a whole, is because of political correctness, the inability to even attempt to do an intelligence analysis of things like radical Islam and its effects, and, you know, in this case, the connection with Hezbollah and other groups in MS-13 and the ability to come across the border. Because I think if we looked at that more closely, I think there'd be even more of a public outcry for safety grounds of what we're allowing to happen right now. Because I think, frankly, if I were in Al-Qaeda, if I were Hezbollah, it'd be extremely easy to get in the U.S. And we have almost no way at the top to even discuss that issue and what's happening because of what we've got at the federal government, which is allowing certain groups that prevent any sort of profiling or discussion that might cause any hurt sensibilities, even to deal with national security. So I know it's a separate issue that was talked about, but I think it's one I just want to throw out there. And again, I'm not the expert in the customs and immigration. I'm just speaking more in terms of what I've seen with the federal government's inability to get past political correctness and the effects that has on a number of areas.
I have a question I want to throw out there. So we get attacked on 9/11, and here's George Bush, and you're with us or with the terrorists. You know, we're losing our rights, Patriot Act, NDAA, Homeland Security, TSA, but we're letting people flood into either side of the borders. I mean, how are I guess I just don't get it. It's almost like this is all the only war is the war on you and I.
Well, you know, it's amazing. The first thing from the TSA was immediately, before anything else, we're not going to profile. And that's just on a law enforcement end. All law enforcement folks I know and I advise the Afghan National Police is just ridiculous. We profile a number of ways, but it is a method of trying to target resources and people and everything else. And it was you would have tend to thought that after 3,000 Americans were murdered that it might have sort of taken us past going to those extremes in political correctness again when we're trying to protect ourselves. But I'll let the expert speak because I'm sure he has more on the immigration side.
Yeah, what I find amazing is that when I read the DREAM Act, which came out 2 years ago, and now his executive order he recently signed, which was just, I believe, what, last month or so, and then his prosecutorial discretion order, which I also read that, it blows my mind that there have absolutely no safeguard for any illegal, you know, immigrant from attacking us. Basically, as Mike Cutler was saying, Iran is sending their own shock troops over into Venezuela, and from there it's a very short hop for Ahmed to become
Miguel and coming across the Mexican border and gaining citizenship, and now we would have shock troops here within the United States, if not, if they're already here. You want
right.
to tackle that one?
Is that for me or for?
Either one.
Okay, I'll jump on it. I've got a study, as I mentioned moments ago, from the House Committee on Homeland Security Oversight. What we have to understand, and what I address in my book, and hopefully people will take that away, is terrorists understand dread. They understand that unpredictable attacks on a civilian populace is a tremendous way to create dread and agitate people. Now, in the study from the major findings of this study by the committee, I'm just going to list a couple of them. Under the major findings, the Texas Department of Public Safety reported receiving their 58 incidents of shots being fired at them by the Mexican cartel operatives in 2009. This becomes important when we consider that experts now believe the southwest border has become the great threat of terrorist infiltration into the United States. And I'm quoting from the report. They go on to say that Iran and Hezbollah have a growing presence in Latin America. Hezbollah has a significant presence in the United States that could be utilized in terror attacks intended to deter U.S. efforts to curtail Iran's nuclear program. And Latin America is attractive because of drug money. And it's become a major laundering and major fundraising center for Hezbollah. And Hezbollah's relationship with Mexican drug cartels, who know the way into the country, they have been working together since as early as 2005. And the last point of the major findings, if Iran's assassination plot against the Saudi Arabian ambassador in Washington, D.C. had been successful, they believe that Iranian forces would have used Los Zetas, the drug cartel, for other attacks in the future. Well, that was foiled, luckily enough. But not knowing this and having had that DHS, you know, advisory program in where condition yellow, which after, you know, 2 years loses meaning, and we move on to the new normal, we're saying, well, I guess it's at least not condition or red or whatever the next level is, and we get used to it. That's what the terrorists bank on. We let down our guard, and then they make their move. The southwest border is wide open.
Yeah, and you yeah. mentioned go ahead, Bill.
I was just going to say, too, that, you know, one of the things you do in military decision-making is you first start in the enemy's shoes in order to defeat them. So you put themselves in their shoes. How are they going to think? How are they going to attack you? Where are your weaknesses? And at this point, after 9/11, I mean, we've got the airplanes covered. I mean, there's been some attempts, the underwear bomber and the shoe bomber. But for the most part, at this point, that attack's really not going to happen again. I mean, we'll keep our airport security. But if I were in their shoes looking at the way to attack us, is it would be a spectacular attack, move in multiple teams throughout the United States and coordinate something to where all of a sudden, you know, you hear about a bunch of malls, schools, everything else, and a bunch of individual shooters. And I'm surmising this based on my MVMP, myself being either Hezbollah, reacting to the sanctions against Iran, and as Iran gets closer to the nuclear weapon, or even Al-Qaeda just attempting to hurt us and pull us back from the Middle East, is that be the way we get hit. And so if I were in the government planning right now, it'd be, yes, keep some focus on the airports, understand that everyone's getting, after 9/11 will never be the same in air travel, but they're not going to do that again. They're going to be focused on what can now work, and what can now work is this whole issue of getting in, again, many teams or possibly dirty bombs, something else of that nature. And that's why it's just amazing that after what obviously we just had read to us about the statistics and the findings and everything else, again, about Hezbollah, the connections with MS-13, with the drug cartels, we've known about this for almost a decade now, and we're just going to wait until another 9/11 type attack, which this one I believe will probably be something more along the lines of throughout major centers throughout the United States, shooters and individuals and that sort of thing, and then scratch our heads as to how this happened. It's amazing.
Yeah, what I find amazing is I think what they did on this past 9/11, they were gauging our reaction with the attack on Benghazi, and very few people mentioned that same day the attack on the embassy in Cairo. And no one seems to be paying much attention to that one.
you had two simultaneous attacks on 9/11, and our government basically did nothing. So what are they going to do when something happens here? They still have people living in tents on Staten Island from Hurricane Sandy. The government is now baffling me.
Yeah.
I'm completely confused. I mean, there's so much interagency backbiting that it's basically dysfunctional. Is that basically what you see, Brett?
Well, getting back to Benghazi, and I just want to throw this up, I think people have to, you know, those that are concerned about security and taking away from the experience of the Benghazi incident, I understand, this is my understanding from news reports, it was not an embassy but a compound. But nonetheless, we had four Americans there, of which there were signals sent out that we need help. So if Americans honestly, in the continental, the lower 48, think for 1 minute that the government has their safety in mind, think again. I mean, we've let four people, without intervening, without military response or anything, get killed. So they were martyred for whatever reason. I know the intelligence out there, the scuttlebutt, the conspiracy theorists, of which I guess I must be one, thinking that there must have been a connection with, you know, gun running through Libya to the Syrian rebels. I don't know. It hasn't been proved yet, but no one's giving a straight answer. So for Americans to think the government honestly has their back when they let four Americans take it in Libya without a response, without bringing anyone to justice, I say think again. Now, as far as the backbiting, absolute competition. The breakdown in the intelligence gathering and sharing before 9/11 was profound. It affected all the border ports involved, the CIA, the FBI, the INS, was largely responsible for keeping people out. And I will just start to say carte blanche. I know I may be giving away the climax of the book, but I'm going to lay it at the feet of the INS based from contributions of others where These hijackers, 15 of 19, were Saudi nationals. They were treated with kid gloves because they were Saudis. They applied for aliases, 23, and got 22. They used 364 aliases. And Atta, who could have been stopped just before the attacks, he arrived from Madrid into Miami Beach, Miami, Florida, actually. He could have been stopped. He claimed to be a student, but he had no supporting documents. But because inspectors for immigration are told, you have 45 seconds to clear a passenger. We have other flights coming in. Do not take extra time. Do not refer people for increased inspection after you talk to them, or we'll send you back for retraining. And so the guys down there let him go. He came in. He was the one who flew the plane into the North Tower. And had he been stopped, he was the coordinator for the group. At least it would have been delayed, maybe stopped.
Why does it matter that they're Saudis? I mean, we're prosecuting an American soldier in Afghanistan wanting to give him the death penalty. Why would we put kid gloves on these Saudis just because they're Saudis? I mean, they're killers.
Well, in the sense of treatment before 9/11, it was because they might be in a position of influence, and there's a certain amount of relationship that the country is concerned with as it relates to oil. So you can go back to big oil and say, oh, you know, it's a conspiracy. But I think that is a fact, and that has come out of some testimony from the inspectors saying when we see a Saudi national, we're under instructions, probably some sort of congressional complaint that was filed by someone, a mover and a shaker in Saudi Arabia, saying my people were held up. I want an explanation. So then Congress would have come down on the INS, which, of course, is going to do whatever they're told, saying you have just a certain amount of time to question these people, and absent a really egregious fact or circumstance, you let them go. And that's how they operate.
Yeah, now, something that Brett writes about in his book also, you outline the incident at Fort Hood and how the FBI and just kind of like didn't even bother to let anyone know what was going on. And then the Army itself having political correctness. I found that very fascinating. Now, Bill, since you are also military, do you find yourself by superiors being forced to be a little bit more politically correct when you do an evaluation?
I want to kind of stay off that, but just go back on the Fort Hood shooting, because you brought up an outstanding point. It actually ties in a little bit, I believe, to the reasons why even with the Saudi nationals, the oil interests, because there's something else here that has a bigger effect, and I think people give it credit for, and that is the effect of internal Muslim groups, some of them having ties to Hamas, even Hezbollah. And I use one example is the influence of CARE on the American government, where the demands to be part of every aspect of planning, of every agency, of any discussion, of, again, we go back to profiling. And when it came to Major Nadal in this case, the things he had written, the things he had said, if they had been any way, shape, or form tied to, let's just say, anti-Semitic or anything else whatsoever, as a major in the Army and as someone who was a medical doctor, he'd have been toast, absolutely beyond the pale toast. That he would have been investigated, would have lost security clearances, he'd have been gone. But because he was Islamic, because of the pressures put down, stuff that was out-and-out treasonous, and out there, noticed that this guy was a traitor to the nation already, and a danger, was just people stayed off it, where in almost any other case, it would have been reported. And you see things reported all the time. I mean, again, just dealing when it comes to issues of security clearances and everything else, the Major Nadal thing is the perfect example of what political correctness has gone amok. And then also the influence, again, of groups that I don't believe their loyalties are to our nation or way of life. They're to undermining moving in eventually. And I don't want to make this sort of Chicken Little, but eventually Sharia law, and that's their vision, are in almost every aspect of our federal government. And they are making decisions. And, in fact, one good example is there was a lieutenant colonel in the one of our senior service colleges who was teaching just the idea of the jihad and what the aims were, to say, look, for the radicals out there, the Salafists, this is what they believe. Well, CARE got involved, and this guy's lost his career. He's a decorated war hero, and one of the top people in his year group is a West Point officer, and lieutenant colonel, probably future general officer, his career is over. And they just came down on him like a sack of bricks. We had the lieutenant general Boykin, Delta Force guy, multi-war, war hero. I mean, just the kind of guy that really is the ultimate Superman for our country. And he was invited to speak at West Point at a prayer breakfast. And because many years ago he had spoken sort of about his Christian evangelical beliefs and how those played out in the battlefield, he was disinvited. He was actually pushed out of it. And that wouldn't happen in any other group whatsoever, except that, again, we've got these pressures from the radical groups, and they're throughout the entire structure of our government, and they have more of an effect than I think people realize. And the main effect is they won't allow the discussion of, okay, let's not get into hatred. Obviously all people are treated equally under the law, but if these people believe in what the tougher things in the Quran, the Hadith, say, and the Salafists meant in the early times of Islam, we better understand those. This discussion gets shut down, and so we can't really analyze our enemy, which is really in military decision-making. You've got to get a truthful, blunt assessment of the enemy, all good, all bad. And we can't do that when it comes to fighting radical Islam. And so Major Nadal is a perfect example of something that would not have happened except for the ultra-political correctness that we're seeing. In fact, actually, the Army Chief of Staff that time came out and called it workplace violence. I mean, just ridiculous. Trying to take away the fact this guy said he's a jihadist, I mean, was influenced, was even directed. In fact, we killed recently one of the people that helped him direct the attacks. So we know he's a jihadist. There's no question whatsoever. And yet that the truth of that continues to be downplayed in trying to make this out to be just sort of a spontaneous outburst of whatever. This guy was a doctor. He was a major, so somewhat senior officer. He was not some crazy guy off the streets that just came in because of workplace violence. He was a jihadist who believes in what he believed in. And we can't even study that line of thought of what he believed in because of our political correctness.
Yeah, matter of fact,
how do we change it? I mean, it seems like President Bush and Barack Obama, two of our presidents that were elected, they're allowing this to happen, as well as our elected officials. How do we change it? What would you do to take steps?
Well, here's the first thing. I think George Bush, for example, was a good man who was misinformed. He didn't know about Islam. The day after 9/11, he had his shoes off in a mosque with an imam who they later learned had ties to terror groups and everything else. So it was quite an embarrassing thing later on they didn't talk about. But, I think generally we want to believe that all of it is a religion of peace because it makes us feel better. It really does. I mean, we naturally, psychologically, don't want to believe that the problem could be that big. And yet I'm telling you, it is that big, that there's a substantial millions and millions of people who believe in this, that believe that we are lesser humans and that Sharia law should cover the earth and everything else. And we've got to face that. And part of that is education. And that's where, you know, I think as citizens, we got to put the pressure on to say, look, this is not a hatred of individuals. And we have freedom to worship. We've always had that. But your actions matter. You know, someone's actions believe in overthrowing the U.S. government, regardless of whether it's Islam or Nazism or whatever it is, that can't stand. That's traitorous. That's treasonous. And we can't allow it. So you can believe in the afterlife. You can believe in whatever you want to believe about the nature of theology. But when your beliefs come into a political theory of establishing Sharia law, ending democracy, ending the U.S. Constitution, at that point you're a traitor. And we have got to be able to face that hard truth. And it's only going to come through citizens becoming educated, putting pressure on people like our president to say, we're not going to stand for you. We're not going to stand for it anymore. Y'all are taking an easy way out because you don't want the what's going to happen with these pressure groups. And they can get you one by one. They can you know, get that lieutenant colonel relieved because he's the only one speaking out. If enough people speak out, they can't take people out one by one. There's strength in numbers. So as people become educated in the aims of those who we face, they're going to put the pressure on the government to say enough is enough. There will be some type of profiling toward those who believe the government should be overthrown and who are traitors. And again, it doesn't matter whether it's anything, Nazism, believing Sharia law, whatever it is, you can believe what you want, but your actions and your beliefs are moving toward overthrowing the government, then, you know, you're an enemy of the government.
Yeah, what I find amazing is how care has insinuated itself so much into the fabric of government and business. And here care has already been, had their 501c3 revoked. They were at one point deemed to be associated with terrorist organizations. And yet, still, the FBI and various other federal agencies still use them to teach people about Islam, CARES version of it. And then you have something like Best Buy that sponsors their annual dinner. The second I saw that, I just went back to Best Buy and returned whatever I had purchased a couple of days before and said, I'm never walking in this store again. And anyone who buys at Best Buy is going to be an idiot.
Right.
It's just amazing how people allow this when they already know this is a horrible organization.
Well, I think a part of the problem is when we see religion, just because of our background or our Judeo-Christian history, and where we come as a Western people, is that religion is between man and God, and it's about beliefs beyond this world. It does affect your living, but we believe in democracy, the people as a whole make decisions. The issue is those who get serious about the sleepest, about the sort of cutting edge of Islam and Sharia law, they see a whole different basic set of way of government, way of life that sees our Constitution, our democracy as being evil. And for those people, it's not about, it's sort of separate out, okay, you can believe in the nature of God, and we may have disagreements about that, and that will be handled once you're dead and you have to face God. But on this earth, you know, we do have to handle actions and beliefs that want to overthrow our system, and that's where we face something different with the Salafists, with the jihadists, that we don't face elsewhere. And it's hard for us to understand that. And we don't want to be bigoted about religion. We've gone through all that in the 30 years of war and everything else. We understand that. But at the same time, we have to understand this is in many ways a political ideology under the cloak of religion that seeks to undermine who we are and our way of life. And that's a tough part of this whole thing.
Yeah, and what we have to get people to understand is that under the Islam that these Islamic extremists want us to have, religion is government and government is religion. There is no separation. And
Right. Everyone
that's screaming that you can't have a crucifix on a public building or the Ten Commandments is demanding separation of church and state, but yet they're willing to allow Sharia law. The hypocrisy is always what amazes me. Mike, I know you got some more questions. I've got two pages here.
I got like 300 million questions. Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt. Were you going to?
Mike, real quick, I hate to do this. I picked my – I think I told you over the email. I can't stay any longer. But I really appreciate the invitation coming on. You've got an incredible expert here, quite frankly. You've got a lot more to say than I do, and I've probably monopolized too much. But I appreciate you letting me on, and I wish you all the best.
All right, well, Lieutenant Colonel, and I hope to see you soon.
Before he goes, I got one quick question for the Lieutenant Colonel. How are you?
Sure.
I mean, it's got to be disappointing to see our own government trying to give capital punishment to a soldier who volunteers to protect our borders and then gets sent to a country and is in charge of building a school. I mean, how do you, as a career-long military person who's loyal to the Constitution, I mean, how does that make you feel? For me, it just frustrates me almost to a point where I just want to pounce people over the head.
Yeah, I'll tell you, being over in Afghanistan, the thing that's so hard to understand is the nature of what you're fighting. I mean, unlike, say, World War II, where you got a German uniform, they're shooting at you, shoot back. In these situations where you've got to move along and wait for the rules of engagement to be met before you can fire back, and the enemy is not wearing a uniform. So they're putting the civilians directly in danger because they're hidden amongst them, they're pulling out weapons whenever, they're doing this sort of thing. When we look at punishment, we look at usually both the men, and I'm attorney civilian life, I mean, the mens rea and the actus reus. The mens rea has got to be there that you're attempting to murder somebody. You know, some of these instances where, again, you're doing your best to follow the rules of engagement, you're doing your best to under an enemy that's not following the laws of land warfare, not wearing uniforms, putting the civilians directly in danger. I can recall one firefight where, you know, these guys were directly firing from behind civilians, I mean, getting us to fire back. And in this case, our guys didn't, and killed the guys once the civilians ran off. The point is that this is what we're fighting. And in some ways, the pressure that's put on about the punishment where they think they found something is one that, you've got to use the mitigating factors of what was the situation, what are the mitigating circumstances, everything else that goes into it, before you start slamming down the gavel, because this is not some situation where people are, you know, premeditating, going out for premeditated murder. I mean, almost none of that's going on. If that does go on, it's quickly punished, and it should be. You know, people trying to do their best, and then hitting them up for those kind of charges is it's pretty amazing.
It is, absolutely. And Lieutenant
Thank you for
Carol,
that
what?
Answer. I know you're
yeah,
going, but thank you for that answer.
I want to thank you for calling in, Bill. And I wanted to ask one quick question. Are you going to be over in North Charleston for the first district candidate forum?
When is that?
That is the 16th. It's not this Saturday, next Saturday.
I'll definitely try to.
All right, great. Then I look forward to seeing
you
up there.
Thank you for the service to this country, too, sir, very much.
Thank you. God bless. I appreciate it. Thanks.
Thank you. That was Lieutenant Colonel Bill Connor. He's a great guy here in South Carolina, and he's a good friend. So now, Brett, what question was I next up to?
Well,
so
hold that thought, and I'll ask a quick question. Why is it we as Americans, while reading the book, are so scared? I mean, it's almost like government is just – it's almost like they're using the media and all this as basically scare us, and then take more of our rights away. And so we think, okay, now we're going to give them this, and this is going to be safer for us. God. Go ahead.
You know, that's basically the premise for the book. You know, the problem is that, and I've written the book for you, for Annie, for Americans to understand the facts of what's going on behind the scenes. So, since they're aggravated, frustrated, stressed out by not knowing, they had to have someone come out and say, this is the real deal here. This is what you have to deal with. But the second to that is preparation. And I think that we as Americans, we have to understand, I think, you know, rewinding a little bit the interview, you asked what can we do about it. I think certainly term limits, but is that something we as American citizens at our level can do? We have to understand. And this is coming from survival books, not survivalists, not digging a bunker in your backyard, but how to survive, the survivor mentality, crisis management. And what these authors have written is they've said the actual threat is not nearly as important as the level of preparation. So what can we do as Americans? the more prepared you are, the more in control you feel, and the less you fear, less fear you will experience. So as far as being fearful, all of us have to prepare. And that involves something I hope to roll out as a solution to that problem, people being afraid. I've seen it over and over again when I've met with people. We need to find ways to keep our kids safe. What do we do with them in school with the shootings? What do we do with our neighbors and our neighborhoods? How do we respond and react? We don't know. There's no leadership. There's a vacuum created. I intend to fill it. It's taking time to figure out what people need, want, and desire. But nonetheless, we have to, at our level, what we can affect, what we can control, we have to be prepared. So in response to the threat, which is often overblown by the government, we move a little further incrementally, and we give up these rights. And in the book, I wanted to establish in the book, listen, it's like, you know, anybody who is a significant force in your life, let's say you had someone who stood up for you when you were a little kid that you could go to, an older brother that would step in harm's way and save you from a bully, or some force to be reckoned with that would protect you, that doesn't exist anymore. It much the same as when I worked at the World Trade Center for a few months, and that was years ago, obviously, when it was still up. I'd sit in the shadow of the World Trade Center. Americans don't understand it because most have not seen it. I've been on the observation deck of that building, whichever tower, you can tell me, looking down on Battery Park. People don't connect with that because they didn't experience, but nonetheless, it's the same feeling that we all have with something in our life we think, you know, that's never going to change. That's always going to be there. Well, you know, it's not there anymore now. The buildings are gone. And the same holds true with our freedoms. We feel that our freedoms will be perpetual freedoms, that the blood that's been shed since the Revolutionary War times was enough to set it in stone. So we don't have to worry about it. But these events come and go. And we're willing, for the sake of security, to sacrifice a portion of our liberty. And we have to realize, in the book, I think, points it out, and I think we have to arrive at the conclusion, we have to prepare that more than likely what's been taken away from us is not going to be returned as easily as we gave it up. And it may be something that has a permanence to it that we're not going to be happy with. So we have to be on guard and be prepared so that when these proposals are made, we can tell the government, you know, we can handle that. We're prepared. We've been going through this. We know the information now, finally. We know what the truth is. So we'll do it ourselves, and we're not going to give this up so easily. You can make a run at it, but we're going to be standing in the way, so be ready for that. And that's where I hope everybody eventually ends up, that that's a societal change, and for the life of me, I don't know how it's going to happen, except slowly, like moving the Queen Mary in a harbor.
Yeah, I agree. What I'm finding is, slowly and surely, with places like Blog Talk Radio, we are seeing more and more conservatives coming out and having their voices heard. We've got a friend of ours, the Exceptional Conservative. He's got his own show here on Blog Talk Radio, and he just bookmarked your page to purchase your book, which is at www.homeland-security.com. Insecurity, I mean, homeland-insecurity.com. I have the link up in the chat room and on the show page, so anyone can click on that and get your book there. I'm telling you, it is a must-read book. And Mike knows I love have the hard copy of a book, and I must have something like about 150 little post-it notes sticking out of the book right now from where I was making notations. We were talking about the DREAM Act earlier, and what was the question I had? Oh, geez, my brain is going through a major fart. But the DREAM Act is one of the major problems that ICE is having, because now they're basically being told they can't do their job. So it changes from administration to administration. So these guys have no idea what their career is going to be like, because under Obama it's one way, under Bush it's another way, and whoever becomes the next president will be a completely different set of rules. Why isn't there a set of rules in stone?
Because they can be changed from administration to administration. In my closing years under George Bush, we had a tremendous amount of work set enforcement cases. We worked where we'd go to a, for example, SWIFT, which is a beef processing plant. And this gets to another question of a jobs Americans don't want, which in my mind has been disproved through my experience that This was in Grand Island, Nebraska. We went down there to arrest the illegal aliens present there without work permits or visas. I think we arrested in a multi-state sweep 600 or 700. I saw a small lab that was set up outside the building. It was an awful place. You know, 6,000 head of cattle would be processed today. So you have animals being slaughtered and processed, and you have all the blood, gore, and everything else that goes along with it. And for those PETA members in the audience wondering, there's only 1/6-inch portion of the tail that's not used. The rest of the animal's all used. So you can imagine having to walk in there with galoshes on that you're not going to slip and fall on this floor. And then there's a holding pond outside, and all the smells and everything that goes with it. And this lab tech, I went and asked her, I said, ma'am, what's happened here? All your signage and all your little roads or streets are all in Spanish. You know, what happened? She said, what took you so long? And I said, I can't explain that. She said, years ago under Clinton, these folks that worked here were Americans. And now the illegals started coming, wages went down. The Americans couldn't afford to work there anymore. So in response, in the aftermath of our raid, wages went back up. Americans came back up, back into the workplace. So people have got to understand that's a key understanding of it. So the DREAM Act and letting people stay and have jobs that, you know, Americans really do want. But we've got this mentality now that's been developed with 99 weeks of unemployment and people rather being on unemployment than finding a job, even not so desirable job as working in a meat processing plant. And here in Georgia, you might understand, we have chicken processing, poultry processing galore. So there's a tremendous presence of the illegals, I believe illegals, from south of the border that were invited by Tyson Chicken to come here and work. And so that explains our presence. But this DREAM Act, getting back to your question, we have politicals that are involved in elections. They look at percentage of Hispanic support. I think Reagan got a little over 30% support from Hispanic vote. George Bush, I think, dropped below 30%. Rush Limbaugh pointed it out very well. He said, do you think for 1 minute that the Democrats are going to propose any sort of cooperative effort for the DREAM Act, for this issue of establishing legal immigrant status to these folks in order to shave off a portion of their 66%+ share of support from the Hispanic community? Any compromise is just to solidify the Democratic side and to solidify what is already there of the Hispanic support. So the Republicans making a mad rush to support the DREAM Act or any compromise really aren't going to get anything out of it. I think that's something they fail to understand because they don't read their history.
Now, and instead, Republicans are so worried about the Hispanic vote, instead of saying, no, this is the legislation we want, we know we're not going to get the votes, so just, you know, write them off right now, and let's just stick by our principles. But instead, they're all becoming wishy-washy.
It's tough not to argue that point. It's true, and we've seen it time and time again, the fact that this is revisited, the fact that we're now witnessing another assault on the Second Amendment gun rights, when it's the same old argument. You know, back in the day when all of this was part of the Founding Fathers' move to ensure that the well-armed militia would keep the government in check, we didn't have the rash of shootings we have now, and I think in part, and could be a large part, our society has changed. There's been a coarsening of our society. There's been a lessening of the attributes of human life as it relates to the beginning and the end of life. So with the violence everywhere in media and the video games and the desensitization of violence, this is what happens. So to continue to attack what is not the problem is just a way to have this, you know, not the left hand not knowing what the right does. And so that's what is used in the immigration, that's what's used in the customs, the Homeland Security issue, the same don't pay any attention to the man behind the curtain from The Wizard of Oz. This is what goes on, and this is what they can get away with, because we as Americans have a new normal in our mind. And we go back to just gas prices, just to sum this up, look at the gas prices we pay. We see a dime reduction, we celebrate, we say, wow, it's much more affordable now, it's under $4 a gallon. I mean, that's how crazy it is. And they know how we work, and they continue to get away with it.
Yeah, that's the shameful part. Now, you also write about the trade wars, because you mentioned gasoline. But
these rules under the new DHS and the new alphabet soups they have on there have actually done more to cause American businesses to go overseas and manufacturing than keeping jobs here. How is that happening?
The best illustration of that was Harry Reid and coming out with when he found out about the Chinese uniforms for the Olympic athletes. Let's collect them, burn them, and start over. I would have to ask, well, gee, Senator Reid, I don't know where we go for those. Maybe there's some producers or suppliers here in the States. But the fact is, I work that as a specialty, trade issues, and I understand it implicitly. What goes on, our trading partners are not our friends, and they're bent on wiping us out in terms of trade. Look at the textile industry in the Southeast. It used to be something that was protected by quota visa systems, which have been eliminated because the industries no longer exist. We have foreign suppliers and manufacturers that are not governed by OSHA. They're not governed by the regulations we have. Safety issues are not a concern. So their labor costs are much, much less. They produce an inferior product in a lot of people's minds, but nonetheless, the labor costs are down. They're cheaper, more affordable, and that's what's brought in. In the meantime, we decimate our industry, or we ship it offshore because of regulation or unions, and the industry leaves never to return unless we make it so favorable, so attractive, reduce our corporate income tax rate to a lower rate, since I think we're the highest, and make it more affordable for American businesses to be here. But the protections that existed, especially in the case of textiles, no longer exist, and then there will be no more protections unless, I suppose, there's either an executive order, not sure how that would work, or a legislative act. So recapturing our freedoms, let alone protections for industries that are very vulnerable, and plus you have then the intellectual property rights theft that occurs, where oftentimes the Chinese would come over to our country and enter into a consortium with other industry, let's say Boeing in this case. They would take the technology out of our country, bring it back to theirs, and make it cheaper. We have the Chinese presence on the Iron Range in Minnesota taking all the steel, the taconite, out of that area to go build their naval fleet. So this is what's happening. This global marketplace has affected our industries, has affected our natural resources, has affected our labor force. So we have this battle on many fronts.
Yeah, actually, it is an actual battle. They want to collapse our economy, thus collapse the nation, and I don't think people understand that, do they?
I don't think so. They are on the naivete that the government's out for our best interest. They maybe at times understand a political agenda that is the actual driving force, whether it's at the Oval Office level or within the agencies, because the agencies, a lot of the management can persist long after the administration is gone, certainly not the top people, but the people second, third tier can go on, depending on, of course, they've stepped on something in the meantime, but these people can persist for a good long time. And the Americans just don't study the history, and they don't understand that all of these forces are coming into play, and they don't know what to do. So first of all, they need to be informed, but the second big thing is they have to be motivated. So there has to be a motivating force where they understand that there is a price to be paid for ignorance, you know, not being aware of this, and they may not like the end result.
That's true. Unfortunately, everyone is not being taught history. And what history has been taught has been distorted, and I'm not even sure how we even tackled the school system to get us back on path to let people know what we were formed, why we were even formed. You know, instead they want us to look like the rest of Europe, and unfortunately we're starting to look like that, and it's very scary. It is very scary. Mike, I know you have a lot more questions, so I don't want to keep on stepping on you here.
No, you are certainly not. I have. Could it be that just we're dealing with a generation of maybe Americans that are exceptionally stupid? They're clueless, and they don't believe that this could really take place? No, because, I mean, a lot of these people didn't go through the grunt things that the greatest generation did. The World War II veterans and the World War I veterans, they just don't believe it.
Well, there's another little-known feature of, and it involves education. It's called the H-1B Visa program. And for those that haven't heard about it, what it is, it's a lottery system where American business can go to the government and apply to get highly trained foreign workers to come here. They can get a 65,000 of the non-PhD level in, I think 20 or 25,000, adding up to 85,000 per year of these folks coming in from India, China, foreign countries, where maybe there's a different style of learning and teaching that we become unaccustomed to, perhaps. I know that some of the people that studied some of the tests, fifth grade tests from, I think, the 19th century and the 1800s, and they found that people can't pass them. But getting back to the H-1B program, you now have thousands of applicants trying to come in, and 85,000 per year times 6, you've got a 500,000 people here taking American jobs. So what happens, the U.S. employer, potential U.S. employer, has to show the government that we've done everything we can to get out and demonstrate that there are no U.S. applicants that are qualified for a position. So there was a law firm out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, I believe Bernstein and Lipset, that came out with some training. And none of this is illegal. None of this is illegal, mind you, so they've done nothing wrong. So here's what their strategy was. We're going to set up an interview process with questions that American applicants cannot possibly answer. We then can disqualify the American applicant in favor of a foreign applicant. And then they qualify the foreign applicant, get them here at sometimes a lesser rate, which is not, they're not supposed to make less in salary, but they often do. And oftentimes they're shifted off of the job they were interviewed for or applied for to something else. And a lot of them overstay or they get green cards. So they can stay and continue to hold what should have been a U.S. held job. But you have to ask, why is business doing that? And I've talked to a few business associates who said, listen, the kids coming out of U.S. colleges can't compete. They don't know the math and science that these fellows do, these men and women from foreign countries. So we have to take a long, hard look at the fact that we've got our kids going into debt for a good long time, hundreds of thousands of dollars in student loan debt that parents are often having to co-sign for. What are they getting out of it? Is it all this kumbaya moment in college where it's all politically correct, where this indoctrination continues on long after high school, and now we're paying for that? So this is a real issue, too, for upcoming generations, where we have foreign-trained, highly skilled people that have American jobs. And that's a lot. That's something a lot of people don't know about, but it's there, and there's no sign of it stopping because it's government-sanctioned. People want it. And in fact,
my follow-up question to that is, we're looking at a huge generation that doesn't read the newspapers or watch the news, which in some ways is a good thing because we know it's just all basically it's owned by individuals pushing agendas. So with that generation being said, is that more at the group of people we hope that would have that attitude where you said of basically, they're not going to put up with it, or they're determined to change it. Because clearly, it seems like a group of individuals who are currently have been voters for a while, have been out of school for a while unemployed, just are not going to. It just seems like a huge group of people, Republicans and Democrats, have just surrendered.
Mike, I wish I could disagree with you. I know that in our walk-a-day life, when we bump into someone of that age, a 20-something-year-old that has a clue as to what's going on, we celebrate it. We talk about it over dinner. And the fact is, it's few and far between. But I think, even in the case of my own, not so much my son, who's always been a conservative, but my daughter, who is part of that, in paying taxes now, being a nurse and studying, continuing to study and acquire more debt, she's seeing the drawbacks of this failed system, this failed philosophy that has never worked. But once again, when you have, I don't know, a handful of publishers that can push out political correctness in their textbooks, and this is what the kids are learning from grade school onward, I don't know how we get in the middle of that except pull the kids out of the government-run education system and homeschool them. So to answer your question, I guess it's not a clear solution out there. I really don't. I wish I was smart enough to say this is where we have to start.
Well, I've got something here that it will prove the point of the education system that we have. This was sent to me from a friend of ours, a GOP marathon man. So I want to thank Paul for saying this. This was in North Carolina editorial page, North Carolina, Beaufort, North Carolina. They say Beaufort, we say Beaufort. And this is a letter to the editor. More modern way of living. Republicans and so-called conservatives are at it again. They are claiming the Constitution gives people the right to have guns without the permission of the government. If that were true, then how come New York and Chicago have laws against it? We Democrats are sick and tired of Republicans constantly using the Constitution to cover up their true plans. I mean, this gets really funny as I go on, which is to make us all afraid of everyone else. Our great president came from a civilized part of the country where there is strict gun control, and he's trying to bring the benefits of that more modern way of living to the rest of us. I don't know the exact statistics, but I'm quite sure that Chicago is a lot safer than Moorhead City when it comes to gun violence. Now, I double-checked this. Moorhead City had one shooting this year. We can't say that for Chicago. He continues. It gets better. It gets better. But do Republicans and conservatives listen to the voice of reason? No, of course not. All they want to do is whine and complain about how gun control and wealth redistribution violate the Constitution, as if the Constitution were all that great anyway. Oh, my God.
Wow.
There are a lot of things that need to be changed about the Constitution, I'd say, and President Obama needs to change it. And this is where it gets really good. The Republicans are just trying to stand in the way because the president is black. They even dare to question whether he was born in this country. I think all this demonstrates the Constitution needs to be amended when it comes to qualifications for being the president. Now, wait for it, wait for it, here it comes. Right now, it says that a person has to be 35 years old and a natural-born citizen. Well, at least he gets that right. Well, that is obviously unfair because there are a great many otherwise qualified people who cannot run for president. I'm trying to do this without laughing, because this is where it gets the best part. Cannot run for president because their mothers had to have a C-section. But because the Constitution was written 100 years ago, no, 226, nobody even thought of the discrimination that would result from a doctor having to deliver a baby in this unnatural way. Now that we Democrats are in control of government, that's just one more thing we can change in our drive to make life fair. And then he puts in, please withhold my name because I don't want to get crank calls.
Wow.
I had to share that. I had to. I got tears running down my eyes right now.
Well, that rules me out. I was C-sectioned.
But, Brett, this is what we have to deal with.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, that is truly the dumbest person or dumbest statement I've really ever heard. Assuming that's natural born.
But, Brett, what do you say to someone like this?
It's incredible. I'm sure they're running, if not already holding, going to run for elected office. And there's a lot of people that will buy off on that. But once again, it's just whether it's contrived or deliberate ignorance of facts, you know, anyone can cite something that they're not actually aware of and cite it as a fact, and it's have any semblance of truth at all. And, you know, I don't know how to undo that knot. It's just, it's craziness.
Well, Brett,
wow.
We're down to our last 6 minutes. We have been having a fantastic time between you and Lieutenant Colonel Connors. I mean, this has been a great show. I'm just sorry about the technical difficulties at the beginning.
Well, that's fine. Everything has been smooth as silk ever since, but you know, I've tried to address, I've been told that we have to address solutions. It has, life is a solution-driven equation. People are looking for answers, and people have to know where to look for answers. They have to get rid of the spin. They have to have a source that's going to tell them like it is without a dog in the fight. So in terms of having an agenda, I don't have an agenda except the truth. Once we've gotten the truth and we can then prepare ourselves at the level we are able to, and get ready, because once prepared, we look for leadership. And through preparation and through knowledge and understanding, we've got to look for the leaders. Look at what happened to Representative Alan West. I mean, what happened in Florida? we look at people like that who have a grasp and appear to be natural-born leaders, stood in the way of care. I was going to bring that up with Lieutenant Colonel when he was on. Stood in the way of care, talking about, I'm tired of care blowing sunshine up, whatever part of the anatomy you refer to, but that's what they do. And those people are lost. So we have to look for those future leaders, whether it's Marco Rubio or Rand Paul, someone who's going to take the standard forward with an informed populace.
You know, we have someone with a question in the chat room. I just noticed it. The exceptional conservative writes, what is the threat of Mexican cartels working with al-Qaeda and causing havoc along the U.S. borders, both north and south?
Well, I've read that. We have Iran opening up, I think, 11 embassies in 9 countries. So the findings of the government, these are not my musings, where they're saying Hezbollah has a significant presence, a growing presence in Latin America, along with Iran, and even a significant presence in the United States that could be utilized in terror attacks intended to deter U.S. efforts. In fact, here's what I wanted to go back to. There was an interview of this poor fellow, a port director, I believe it was in San Diego, and a reporter asked him on Fox, listen, have there been any incidents of the smuggling of weapons of mass destruction into your country? This goes back to the 10% of merchandise that's inspected. And the pressure is from the business community not to inspect. There are programs now involving businesses that are saying our supply lines are safe, and the government is not looking at anything. They're letting everything through because company, corporation XYZ is the importer. So because they're the good guy importer, it doesn't matter. Someone could have slipped something in there, and it comes. He said, you mean weapons of mass destruction at this port? And the public affairs officer jumped in real quick to defuse what could have been a crazy situation with him saying, well, it's been at other ports, and this is the potential that's out there with only looking at 10% or less of what's actually coming in. So
wow.
The answer is yes, Hezbollah can be raising a lot of cane with going both directions, but why attack Mexico when they're on your side, at least the Zetas, in getting you into this country to raise havoc?
Well, Brett, I want to thank you for coming on, and I welcome you back anytime. And your book is up on your website, which I put a link in the chat room, which is homeland-insecurity.com.
What a great title for that book, too. I mean, it's so Homeland Insecurity.
And I would invite your listeners to send me an email at brett@homeland-insecurity.com. I'd love to hear from them and continue to answer questions. I really appreciate the forum. I appreciate the concept and format of Block Talk Radio. It's unbelievably free. It's terrific.
I hope it stays free. Thank you so much, Brett.
Thank you.
Mike, we have some great guests coming up. Our next guest on Tuesday is Horace Cooper of Project 21 and the National Security Council. So Horace will be joining us. And then the following week, we have Bob Barr, the former representative from Georgia, will be with us. And he is, again, running for office. So we have some great people. And I
what office is Bob Barr running for?
I believe it's for the House of Representatives. So we have some great guests coming up next week.
I always liked – he was always such a good layman speaker. He was a lot like Newt to where his, he could speak and you could understand it. He didn't talk all these big words where you're thinking, like, what the hell is this guy talking about? Bob Barr was always a down-to-earth person. So, well, I guess we'll see each other on Tuesday.
Absolutely. So I hope everyone has a healthy, happy, and safe weekend. So until then, good night and God bless.
Have a good weekend, everybody.
If you find yourself in trouble, count on me, my friend. I'll get right up. Trouble
you've been listening to Southern Sense Blog Talk Radio. Producer and your hostess extraordinaire is Ann Ubelis. The theme music, American Stand Up, is written and performed by Don Fortney. For more from Don, check out his webpage, teapartymusic.webs.com. Southern Sense the proud member of Ghost Fighter Radio and Freedom Media Network. Southern sense is common sense. Take it out, Don.
American.